Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. As so often in history, the word meritocracy was invented by an enemy. In The Rise of the Meritocracy, published in 1958, British sociologist Michael Young warned that meritocracy would not only condemn to helpless despair the many who have no merit, but create a new class society founded on the privilege of intelligence. 60 years on, Young's analysis remains powerful. Elite education is more competitive than ever, and the share of the world's wealth owned by the new meritocratic super-elite is many times higher than in Young's day. That new inequality has bred resentment, and a crisis of meritocracy is now recognized in the West. But in his latest book, The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World, Adrian Wooldridge takes issue with those critics who want to do away with elements of the meritocratic order. From leading lights in academia to populist politicians. We must restore faith, he argues, in meritocracy's revolutionary potential. Not only because it is fair, but because it is necessary for the West's survival in a globalizing world. Adrian, welcome. Many books have been written this past year on meritocracy, and you cite moral philosopher Michael Sandel and legal scholar Daniel Makovits, but in The Aristocracy of Talent, you want to offer something else, a history of meritocracy. Why was it so important that you explore meritocracy from this historical perspective?
Well, my book is a history with attitude, as it were. It's a history, but also a defence. And the reason is that I think it's important to understand that meritocracy didn't spring fully formed from the head of Zeus, as it were, like Minerva, that it was the product of a historical development. And also very important for the defense of meritocracy to understand that meritocracy was a reaction against a very different world in which position was determined by birth, by patronage, by sale. So we shouldn't be thinking about meritocracy as an abstract philosophical problem, as Sandel does, or indeed as a legal contrivance and an abstract legal problem, as to some extent Markowitz does. We should think of it as something that has developed over time. And in order to understand just how progressive a role meritocracy has played in the history of the world, we need to set it against the world that existed before meritocracy.
Your title, The Aristocracy of Talent, is inspired by various terms used by meritocratic reformers. So Thomas Jefferson talked about the natural aristocracy. Thomas More wrote about a true nobility. Can you explain the origins of this line of thought and why it's so relevant to understanding meritocracy today?
Well, I think if you want to go back to the beginning of meritocratic thought, you need to go back to Plato. And Plato says that human beings come in three varieties: men of gold, men of silver, and men of bronze. And he says that the men of gold are the true aristocrats because they are people who are distinguished by a philosophical understanding of the way the world ought to be. And they're not determined by birth. They're not landed aristocrats necessarily. He says that men of gold can be born into any class, and that you have to have a system of social mobility to promote people into the right class. He also says, and this is a crucial and also extraordinarily sort of progressive for his time, he also says that men of gold might also be women of gold, that there's no reason why women ought not to be, you know, part of this natural ruling class. So he's making a distinction between natural rulers, that is people who are born with this golden attribute, and inherited rulers, landed rulers. And he says absolutely central to his philosophy is that you need to identify true nobility, i.e. this gold quality that he talks about, and distinguish that from inherited land holding, and that you need to have in every single generation a process of social mobility whereby these men of and women of gold are promoted. And this is this line of thought that goes all the way through the Middle Ages, all the way through the Renaissance, where a lot of Renaissance humanists talk about it, to the Enlightenment and to the, you know, people like Jefferson, people like Thomas Paine, who are constantly making this distinction between a real aristocracy and a sham aristocracy, or what Jefferson calls a sort of a glittering but unreal aristocracy, an aristocracy of appearances rather than of substance. And the reason why it's so important to talk about this distinction, I think, is that meritocratic thought depends fundamentally on making a distinction between the people who have power and the people who ought to have power, the people who are naturally able and the people who are only able because they've had advantages in life.
So it's really, meritocracy is really then a way of thinking about the world.
It is. Meritocracy, fundamentally, and one reason why I wrote a historical book and one reason I wrote a book that champions meritocracy is a critique of the way the world is. And a lot of people today have turned against meritocracy because they say meritocracy is propaganda for plutocrats, that it's a celebration of the current social order. I think if you look at the history of meritocratic ideas, all the way back to Plato, it is a critique of the way the world is and a belief that says you need to have in every generation a dynamic recalibration of social position in order to match opportunity with ability.
And it seems to sort of get on top of mind every time we have sort of crisis of state or war. How important were these moments of crisis in the emergence of the idea?
One of the most important things to remember about a meritocracy is it's not just that it's a critique of the status quo, but it's a self-renewing idea. And whenever you have a big crisis in the state, brought about by war or brought about by the rise of a new class of wealth and power, you have meritocracy renewing itself. So if you think, for example, about the late 19th century in the United States, you have then a very powerful critique being brought by the progressive movement of the world as has hitherto existed, which says that it's not sufficiently meritocratic because the politics is corrupt, because the universities only educate the children of the rich rather than educating people of ability, and because the school system doesn't do enough to reach down to the very bottom of society and incorporate new groups, particularly new immigrant groups. So meritocracy has always, throughout its history, been a cry of reform and a cry of renewal, very far from being the celebration of the status quo that some people claim that it is.
We'll come back to the idea, to meritocracy being a sort of revolutionary idea. But I think you do something else in the book as well, which I think is fascinating and makes, at least in my mind, your argument more convincing. Because you also show that actually these other systems of hereditary titles or buying and selling positions, they're actual systems, and the system in many ways also works. So there's a logic to it. It's too simplistic to just say that it's corrupt. Can you tell us a bit about the logic of buying and selling military positions?
Sure. Well, let me say that for many people might say that how come you're celebrating meritocracy? Surely we all believe in meritocracy. Surely you're just celebrating ice cream or apple pie or something that's very obvious. And my argument against that is that actually for most of human history, we haven't had meritocratic societies. Mm. We haven't had the idea that your right to have a job should be closely linked to your ability to perform that job. We've had a society which has been based on inheritance, a society which has been based on the notion of stability, that the best society is the one in which people continue to live in the positions that they're born into, because that's, you know, a just reflection of what God wants or what nature wants. And also a society in which you have a system of buying and selling jobs. Jobs were treated, you know, for much of history rather like bits of furniture. You could you owned them and you could sell them. And one of the most extraordinary things about that is not that it was completely pervasive, most gloriously and extravagantly so in France, but also in Britain and right across the continent, but also that it has a certain logic. That it's very easy to say, well, this is corruption, this is old corruption, this is a terrible way of running the world. But actually, for much of history, it actually bore some sort of logic. Let's take the example of buying and selling military positions. A commission in the army in Britain was something that was bought and sold on a market with market prices right the way up until the reforms of the 1870s. And the reason that people would buy this position is that they could get loot, essentially, that if you were fighting in a battle, you could get rich by defeating the enemy and getting his property and the property of the state. So that gives you in economic terms, it makes a lot of sense. It gives you an incentive to fight. It gives you a reward system. And it's cheap for the state. The state doesn't have to take on, for example, the issue of the pension of the soldier, which was a very big potential cost, because the soldier would simply, when he was retiring, sell on his commission to somebody else who is younger and live on the proceeds of the sale of the commission. And, you know, there's a lot of resistance in the 1870s. One of the biggest resistances came from the government. He said, what are we going to do about pensions? We'll have to pay pensions. And that's a big cost in the future. So the system that existed before meritocracy has an internal logic. It's not just a pure matter of corruption, and it's something that works. And that, you know, if you think about it, that has to be the case, because the world existed for century upon century upon century according to this principle. Now, I think meritocracy comes along and is a superior position, a superior way of doing things. But it's not. It's not as though the pre-existing system has no virtues to it.
But it also what makes it such a revolutionary idea. I mean, if the old system just didn't work at all, it wouldn't have been revolutionary. It's just been sort of common sense. But, and it's very much specific to the modern age. So the great modern revolutions in France and America features in your book. And what is striking is the extent to which they failed to create meritocratic societies. So in France, for example, meritocracy wrestled with the contradictions of the absolutist state, as you describe in your book. How far did it succeed?
Well, France is an extraordinary story because, you know, the greatest of modern revolutions in many ways, so certainly the bloodiest and the one that throws up the most interesting philosophical debates. And France, I think, is to some extent an egalitarian revolution. There is an element within the French left, the revolutionary left, that says they just want to destroy all hierarchies. But I don't think that's the dominant element. The dominant element is the one that says, let's replace artificial tinsel aristocrats with natural aristocrats. Let's create a new social order based upon ability, a new nobility of merit. And, you know, that because the revolution is so dynamic and unstable, it takes a long time for that sort of to emerge. And then you have the genius of Napoleon coming along, who claims, as it were, to be a meritocrat, claims to believe in the career open to talents and the field marshal's baton being in the knapsack of every soldier. But also Napoleon has this other characteristic, which is that he quite likes the idea of being an emperor. And of making his children princes and of creating a new Napoleonic dynasty. So immediately the French sort of revolution is sort of compromised by this peculiar sort of ricocheting between pure meritocracy on the one hand, a Legion of Honor on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, a return to a dynasty and Napoleon putting his family in charge of lots of different countries. And then right the way through the 19th century in France, I think you get this, again, ricocheting between the forces of the revolution on the one hand and the forces of dynasticism on the other hand. So a very unsettled unsettled relationship. So in France is in many ways rhetorically the greatest revolution in terms of the creation of meritocracy. And France does create a very meritocratic state with an exceptionally meritocratic educational system, but it's also drawn between royalists and radical revolutionary principles which keep popping up all over the place.
So meritocracy has always had to wrestle with entrenched privilege, yes, and nepotism. And, yes, and the way you describe it, pre-modern world is that of degree, priority and place.
Yep.
But you also identified two societies that embraced some form of meritocracy in the past, ancient China, and you also talk about the Jewish people. How and why did these societies embrace meritocracy?
Well, in very, very different ways and in fascinating ways. In a very serious way, the world's first meritocratic society, the world's first examination state is China. And China really becomes a society in which the emperor is surrounded by a group of Confucian scholars who are chosen on the basis of merit in the very early Middle Ages, you know, at a time when Britain is being ruled by people with names like Harold Bloodaxe. China is being run by Confucian scholars selected by examination by, you know, the 7th century onwards. And this examination system, it lasts right the way from the early Middle Ages to the beginning of the 20th century. It's an examination system which is based upon a certain select group of Confucian texts, so basically the same texts throughout this whole time. And it's also an enormous system. So about 10% of the population of China goes through these examinations, and the examinations will select people. The top of the tree is to work for the emperor in Peking, but you could also become a local administrator or a regional administrator, all on the basis of passing examinations. And although the examinations do demand, you know, a lot of cultural capital, they demand an ability to read and interpret Confucian texts. They do reach quite deeply into Chinese society, and there is a lot of social mobility that is generated purely by people's ability to perform in examinations, and families will invest a huge amount of money and time and effort in training their children for these examinations. So this is an examination system essentially determined by the service to the emperor and the right to rule over chunks of a very stable imperial state. Now, the Jewish version of meritocracy is very different because it's tied up with mobility, essentially. The Jewish people lose their land and are scattered right across the world. But because they are scattered across the world, they put an enormous emphasis on their cultural identity, which is embodied in the holy texts, but also their intellectual ability, which is embodied in their not just their ability to read and interpret these very complicated texts, but also their ability to engage in mathematics or writing, legal contracts or transactions. So they are the people, I think, in the world, apart from the Chinese, who put the most emphasis on intellectual abilities, but for a very different reason from the Chinese, not because they're governing a stable state, but because they're having to survive as middlemen in a very unstable world.
We already mentioned Plato. And I think it's striking just how far Plato inspired later meritocrats. I mean, we take, for example, the American founding fathers, but also the architects of the European Union. Explain his singular influence.
Well, Plato has a singular influence, I think, for two reasons. Partly because he understands the limitations of democracy, of certainly of pure democracy, and he emphasizes constantly the fact that democracy is unstable and that it's short-termist. And I think his description of the problems with democracy, and he likens democracy to a coat of many colours that superficially is attractive, but is rather tawdry and falls apart very, very quickly. His description, by the way, of the way that democracy turns by its internal contradictions into tyranny, and the way that tyranny embodies the psychological problems of the tyrant himself is an incredibly accurate description of the Trump presidency. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary passage in Plato. But Plato is very critical of democracy in its purest form. And he's also Worried about some of the internal contradictions of meritocracy itself. He says we should have a system in which the men of gold rule, but in order to have a system in which meritocracy works well and properly, we need to make sure that the family is replaced by communal child rearing, and various things connected with communal child rearing, including state sponsored orgies, which Plato is very, very keen on. And we need to get rid of private property. So two fundamental insights by Plato: one, that democracy doesn't work very well, and two, that meritocracy, in order to work properly, needs lots and lots of safeguards. Now, to comment on those two, I think that on the dilution of democracy, although that may seem a bit anti-democratic, actually, it's extraordinary the extent to which democratic regimes have listened to Plato and have said, well, we need to dilute democracy a bit with a bit of meritocracy. So the founding fathers said, well, we need to have a House of Congress, which has elections every 2 years, but we have a Senate, which has elections every 6 years. Well, originally they weren't elections, they were appointed by the states. And we need to have a Supreme Court, which is not subject to election at all. So you're building in safeguards, and they continue to build in safeguards, you know, by making the Federal Reserve independent from political interference like that. So the argument there is the best form of democracy is one that includes an element of meritocracy in order to encourage people to look further ahead.
Meritocracy or an element of technocracy?
Both. Well, if you're dealing with, let's say, a banker, I mean, an independent central bank, that is technocracy. If you're dealing with a Supreme Court, I think that is meritocracy, because it's because the court is not just applying a set of rules, it's applying a reading of text based on deep philosophical wisdom is the ideal of these things. And then, of course, the European Union, because the European Union was so shocked by what happened with the election, essentially, of Hitler once, and that was it. They built in a lot of safeguards against pure populism. And I think Plato is constantly thought about and even cited there. On the issue of meritocracy's failings, I think what we have tended to see in recent years is that the things that Plato said about meritocracy, that you get families that would take advantage of the system and become rulers, meritocratic dynasties, or that you would have politicians who would use their power to get lots of money from the system. Well, this is actually what we've seen, you know. And so Plato's worry that meritocracy could itself be degenerate, so it needed to be surrounded by safeguards, is quite right. Now, obviously, the safeguards that he chose, abolishing the family and abolishing private property, were absurd and would never be done. But he did fix on the two problems that have haunted meritocracy. One, the desire of successful families to perpetuate their success, and secondly, the temptation of politicians of the ruling class to entrench itself by accumulating lots of property. He was completely right about those two things. So everything goes back to Plato, I think, that he is the deepest thinker of them all on this subject.
A core problem, though, with meritocracy is, of course, what is merit?
Yes.
and there's obviously been many ways of trying to everything from examinations to certain standards, etc. But can you tell us a bit about the origins of IQ testing?
Yeah.
And why you think, because you actually think it can work to restore genuine meritocracy, in a sense.
One of the things that my book is a history of different conceptions of merit. And merit has, you know, it's a protean term of being very many different conceptions. So Plato, when he's talking about men and indeed women of gold, he's talking about people with a philosophical temperament and education. He's talking about an ability to see the world as it is rather than as a set of illusions. When you're going to the Enlightenment or the American Revolution, French Revolution, American Revolution, or the Enlightenment that leads to both of those things, they talk constantly about, they don't talk about ability, they talk about talents in the plural and virtues in the plural. So it's very much a notion that there's a collection of talents that you might have, but also a collection of virtues that you have. So character and merit are are character and intellectual ability are sort of conflated together. And indeed, probably virtue is regarded as the more important of the two. And that's true all the way through the 19th century. So the 19th century education reforms, which are about trying to construct a meritocracy, are also about trying to create a guardian class that has virtue and character at its heart. And what happens in the 20th century, I think, is you get a sort of demoralization of the idea of merit. You get an association of merit much more closely with intellectual ability and an association of intellectual ability with IQ, your ability essentially to process information or solve puzzles or think in a sort of cognitive way. So that becomes the sort of central issue, and it's built into the SAT system, which selects people for universities in the United States, into the 11 plus system, which divided children between, you know, the passes and failures of the 11 plus at 11 in Britain. So it sort of informs and drives an enormous amount of social policy. I actually think IQ testing is a very valuable thing in terms of identifying talent or identifying promise. Because what we're concerned about, you know, we're concerned about looking for the men and women of gold, looking for promise and getting the promise as early as possible so that we can identify promise and train. But once you've identified it, I think you do then have to think much more than seriously than the IQ testing people did about the second issue, which is character and moral values. I think we have created a meritocratic class today, which is too self-satisfied, too preoccupied by its own rights to position and not enough concerned with what it owes to society in general. So education has not put enough emphasis on character in the way that the Victorians did.
And would you say that the meritocratic class of today, because this has been nature and nurture, I suppose,
sure.
but I mean, there is a valid critique in saying that actually many of the people who now at our top universities, they've been giving a head start that is,
massive,
I mean, it's you can't even compare that to what if you go to a school in a poor area.
Massively so.
And so it's also very hard to know what is actually merit here, isn't it?
Very hard. So, I mean, one of the arguments I make in my book is that we've seen over the last 40 or 50 years a sort of marriage between meritocracy and plutocracy. Money and merit have got married to each other. And that means that people who are born into privileged backgrounds put an enormous emphasis on passing their privileges to their children in the form of educational success. If you think about the early 20th century, probably educational success was not absolutely the obsession of somebody who has a gigantic grouse moor in Scotland. Now, even people who have a lot of money think about educational success, and obviously people who are lawyers or journalists will think about educational success for their children. So the whole of this sprawling upper class that we have is now thinking about educational success and transmitting that educational success to their children. And they are pretty successful at doing that. You know, you have Harvard, I think, has about 1% of students at Harvard come from from the working classes. You know, 90% come from the upper classes, the richest people in society. That's the same as I think true for most American universities. A school like Eton is an exceptionally academically successful school as well as training people in leadership and all of those things. So you are seeing a group of people transmitting their wealth and privilege to their children and holding on to their positions as a result of that, which is one of the reasons why I'm a believer in IQ testing used to identify talent very early on and educational selection used to take people who don't come from particularly privileged backgrounds but who clearly do have a lot of ability to give them the equipment to compete with people from the upper middle classes whose parents are pushing them very hard. And I think that is an enormously important part of what meritocracy is. At the moment, we have opportunity hoarding by people at the top of society. And I think the best way to prevent that opportunity hoarding is to have more emphasis on educational selection and early identification of talent. And I think we're beginning to move in Britain in the right direction. There's something called the Brampton Manor Academy in the East End of London, which has most of its children come from ethnic minority backgrounds. I think most of them, or certainly a very significant proportion of them, have free school meals, which is obviously a very good measure of the poverty of their parents. And that gets more children into Oxbridge every year than Eton does, or roughly the same, actually. It fluctuates more or less, but roughly the same. And there's a number of academy schools in Britain, in poor parts of Britain, that are doing incredibly well in finding and training academically very able people. So the academy movement, which was pushed by both the Blair government and the Tory government, is all about looking for excellence and giving excellent people the right academic stimulus for them to succeed. And you will find by the pure logic of numbers that there are huge numbers of those in the working classes.
And it's also interesting, if you look at the history, especially during the 20th century or 19th century and 20th century, who are the people who are actually championing meritocracy? This is really sort of, it comes from, I mean, you see it within the Labour movement in the UK, obviously, also the women's liberation and the women's movement.
Absolutely.
Tell us a bit about that, and then I want to look at, well, as sort of the critique from the left, because first of all, you had a defence from the left and a critique from the left.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, again, one of the reasons why I wanted to write a history book primarily, rather than the sort of philosophical defence or legal defence, was that if you look at the history of meritocracy, you find that the people who have seized on this idea and pushed this idea are not the establishment. They're people who are outside the establishment who want to get ahead in life. So in the middle of the 19th century in Britain, you've got what I would call the sort of the educated middle class. They are the people who argue in favour of open competition and examinations in the civil service and Oxford fellowships and things like that, because they want to be given a chance to get those positions and take them away, as it were, from the landed aristocracy, which had traditionally monopolised, you know, the upper reaches of the state and the educational system. So first of all, it's the educated middle class, but then you get new groups coming along saying exactly the same thing, appealing to this objective criteria of merit to say, why not us as well? First of all, you get the sisters of the educated middle class. These educated middle class people are basically men. Well, they are men who say, well, we want to share, you know, Oxford fellowships and running the civil service with all these landed aristocrats, or we want to take it away because we're better. But then the sisters say, well, if you can do it, why can't we do it? Mm. And so you get women saying, we should have public schools, we should have university, we should have places in universities. They're knocking on the door of established institutions. We should sit for the civil service examination. And the people who are monitoring the system, people are saying, well, we believe in open competition. We believe in examinations that test abilities. We believe that everybody should be allowed to compete on their merits, but we don't believe in women being allowed to do it. That's crazy. Ultimately, that doctrine cannot survive. Mm. And so the logic of meritocracy is to open opportunities to talent wherever it's found. It's not a restrictive system. It's something by its own internal logic. So this happens massively with the women's movement, that, that actually, you know, women weren't allowed to take degrees in Cambridge University until 1948, because it's extraordinarily late. But once they're allowed to take degrees, once they do just as well as the men, the logic of open competition means eventually, as now, you actually have more women in universities than you have men in universities. The other group that comes along and does the same thing are, of course, the working classes. You have this extraordinary pressure from self-educated working class people who say, we want to sit for these exams to get into the civil service. We want to sit for these exams to get into Oxford and Cambridge. We want what you've got. We've just as clever as you are. We've studied just as much Shakespeare or just as much Virgil or just as much Homer, and we should get your positions. And of course, you know, it's a slow process at first because they haven't got the educational opportunities. But gradually, as educational opportunities open up, so you get the working classes moving into the system, even, you know, even if it means learning Latin and Greek, you know, in their spare time. And you see an opening up of all of these institutions. And what fascinates me is the way that the logic of meritocracy is one that leads towards opening up of institutions and fair competition. So there are a lot of people who have critics of meritocracy who say, well, it's all the ruling classes who construct these ideas and impose them on everybody else. They determine what merit is and they force everybody to play by their rules, but they don't. Merit is something that is self-reinforcing and sort of self-adjusting. You know, once people say, once you say we believe in open competition and testing on the basis of ability, you will open opportunities to a much broader segment of society. So the people who created open competition in Britain in the middle of the 19th century never thought that women or people from, you know, Leeds working class communities would climb to the top of society. But the logic of the system they created is that they would.
But why did the left change on it? I'll generalise a bit here. Yeah. But why did the left change on this topic and on this idea?
So the most, I would say, you know, meritocracy is a progressive idea. And the people who pushed for it most were, first of all, the sort of the liberal party in the mid to late 19th century, the Gladstonian liberals. But in the 20s, as the 20th century develops, the people who are pushing hardest are the working class people represented by the Labour Party. The Labour Party is the party of meritocracy. It says we don't want a society run by aristocratic cliques. We want a society run by the best people you can possibly have, who, you know, simply because the logic of numbers will overwhelmingly be working class. And the Labour Party is the champion of meritocracy all the way through the Second World War. In 1945, they sort of create an educational system which is designed to be meritocratic. It's a system which has the 11 plus, it has grammar schools, it has secondary moderns. It has an enormous emphasis on upward social mobility. It has an enormous emphasis on giving jobs to people on the basis of their talents. And you have these great meritocrats who've risen from nothing, like Ernie Bevin, you know, left school at 11, went through a very hard time, but knows that he's cleverer than everybody else, knows that he's a greater personality than everybody else, and becomes Britain's foreign secretary, and the greatest foreign secretary in many ways that we've had. So you have this extraordinary upsurge of talent from the bottom of society. Then, and the Labour Party sees itself as the party of merit, and it sees the Tory Party as the party of a decaying aristocracy. Then something very extraordinary happens, which is in the late 50s, in the 1960s, and then even more in the 1970s, the Labour Party says, no, we don't want to be the party of merit anymore. We want to be the party of real equality. And they start saying meritocracy is too competitive. It's all about equality of opportunity rather than equality of result. We in the Labour Party believe in community. We in the Labour Party believe in equality of results. We're a communitarian, egalitarian party. And I think a lot of that is, part of it is taken up by the sort of revolt of younger Labour Party people against the, you know, the people who dominated the party in the Second World War and after the Second World War. It's a sort of generational thing. But part of it is the idea that, you know, it's the 60s, you know, we're getting rid of all of these hierarchies. We're going towards a society which is less competitive, more communitarian, more progressive. So you get rid of the grammar schools, you replace them by comprehensive schools, and you also get rid of a lot of streaming and a lot of examinations and have a, you know, progressive education based on people letting it all hang out. There's a sort of a general revolt against hierarchy. And I think one of the extraordinary things that happens as a result of this is it's a sort of a paradox of good intentions, that once you get rid of grammar schools, in fact, Oxford, as an example of this, starts then taking more and more people from public schools, by which I mean private schools, independent schools, because simply they continue to churn out sort of scholars. They lose their biggest competitors, which are the grammar schools. So you get the upper reaches of British society actually becoming more congealed and more part of, you know, an upper class, more dominated by an upper class clique.
But there's a critique from the right as well.
Yeah.
And what does it look like?
Well, the critique from the right, so I've talked about what happens in the 1960s and 70s with the left revolt against meritocracy. And of course, I should have added there that there's the great book which was written by Michael Young called The Rise of the Meritocracy,
yes,
which coined the term meritocracy. And when he was talking about the rise of the meritocracy, that was a critique. He was saying this is a bad thing. He didn't like meritocracy at all. He coined the term as a condemnatory term. Then what you get much more recently, in the last decade or so, is a revolt of against meritocracy from the right as well. So you have Brexit and you have the Trump movement, both of which have an interesting characteristic in common. They're the revolt of the exam flunking classes against the exam passing classes. So Trump says that he's on the side of the poorly educated, the phrase that he uses. He says, and this is basically the idea that the society has been run by a cognitive elite, which is arrogant, which runs looks down on people, and which actually has made a bit of a mess of running the world, as we know, primarily through the financial crisis, but also through the Iraq war and various other things. So a populist revolt, which identifies intellectual excellence as being a symbol of arrogance and also being a bit of a sham. And what we see at the moment, I think, is, and this is the first time we've seen this in the history of the meritocratic idea, is that both people on the right and people on the left have lost a lot of their patience with meritocracy and are quite vigorously criticising it.
One thing that's important, I think, to point out here is, of course, that meritocracy doesn't necessarily lead to just a good outcome.
No.
So it's a bit like democracy in that sense that, given the alternatives.
Yes.
And I wonder, where are we today? Where, if you look at now, is it even possible to get a new sort of meritocratic movement in this day and age if we look at the critique that's been launched against the ideal?
Sure. I would say that my argument in the book is that what we need is not to reject meritocracy, but to revive meritocracy, that there have been a series of processes. Whenever meritocracy looks as if it's running out of steam historically, as I say, it did in the late 19th century, for example, in the United States, you've had a movement of reform which broadens the base of meritocracy and improves the way that able people are selected through the meritocratic system. And I think that we need exactly the same to get again. So meritocracy has become decadent, and it's become decadent precisely because of this marriage between money and merit, which means that people with wealth have become very successful at transmitting educational privileges to their children. But I say in the book, we need to reform meritocracy by broadening the base, by making sure that we search through the whole of society, in every corner of society, for talent, and make sure we're looking for real talent rather than just achievements. So using as objective tests like IQ tests, rather than just tests of your ability to do Latin and Greek or something like that, to give an extreme example. And also, I think, much more civic education amongst people who are successful, that actually they're not successful purely through their own efforts. They're successful through a degree of luck, that they've inherited genes that mean that they're intellectually able, and that also that whoever is successful has to give something back to society. So sort of Victorian civic ideal, I would say there. So we need to revive the meritocratic spirit, not to get rid of it. Because if you get rid of it, what happens? I think if you get rid of it, you move back to a system of patronage or corruption or a system in which power is inherited by family power, or a system in which you actually don't have competent people doing jobs, which worries me more and more, that you're simply not using the right filters to get people. So reform the system. Is it possible to reform the system. Well, I'm very, very pessimistic about the United States. You know, a country which regards itself as the world's greatest meritocracy, a country with, in many ways, the most successful meritocratic revolution. But now we have a left in the United States, which is pretty much against meritocracy, and a right, which has become a sort of tribal party, you know, surrounded, you know, Trump is likely to be the next Republican nominee. And he's somebody who surrounded himself by his, you know, members of his family or members of his, of almost of his fraternity, of his corporation, you know, certainly not a meritocrat in any sense. So on both sides, in the left and the right, I think a sort of conspiracy against merit. I'm much more optimistic about Britain. As I say, I think the Academy movement has been very, very successful in broadening the base. And it's demonstrated that that if you preach a message of excellence and success in inner city schools, you can, you know, it can produce fantastic results. I think Oxford and Cambridge are doing a lot to broaden their base. So I think Britain is going in the right direction. But the other thing that really worries me, particularly in the context of the United States, is that we're not the only people in the world. There's the question of China, the world's oldest meritocracy, as it were, the country that came up with the idea first. And again, China is now trying to revive the spirit of meritocracy. It has very selective or competitive examination systems. It has, you know, a massively expanding university system. It has a system of promoting Communist Party members on the basis of exam performance or success or various performance measures. It's you know, committed to some extent, to a meritocratic future. So America is abandoning meritocracy at precisely the time when China is really re-embracing it. Only this time, it's not trying to select through its examination systems Confucian scholars who can read Confucian texts. It's, you know, selecting scientists and engineers and biologists and people who can shape the future. No, it's not a perfect meritocracy. There's all sorts of corruption. There's all sorts of red princes who are given every advantage in life. But if there is a possibility that China will become like a giant Singapore, if China becomes a giant Singapore over the next few decades and America continues to go down this woke, anti-meritocratic path, I have absolutely no doubt that China wins and America loses.
So meritocracy is no longer only a political issue, it's a geopolitical issue.
Massive geopolitical issue. And I think that, well, I mean, the example of Singapore is an extraordinary example of how you can have a society which isn't a Western democracy, but which has nevertheless used this idea of merit, used both the Confucian tradition and the sort of, you know, the Platonic tradition to sort of create an education system which is fantastically successful at, you know, searching the population for talent and putting that talent into the service of the state and, you know, the economy. And, you know, probably the world's greatest meritocracy at the moment. And, you know, if China does become like that, I think that will make up for a lot of the other problems with Chinese society.
What is the one thing that the West needs to do to reaffirm meritocracy today?
The West needs to understand that meritocracy is a progressive principle, not a sort of billionaire's charter or a way of solidifying the status quo. It is a way, it's the best way that we have of reconciling principles of justice with principles of economic efficiency.
Adrian Wooldridge, thank you very much.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.